This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The TV version of this program airs now on Free Speech TV, weekdays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Free Speech TV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. Poverty-stricken Americans are often stuck in vicious cycles, borrowing money from predatory lenders off of their paychecks and then getting caught in paying off exorbitant interest rates. Well, that's not because they're being irresponsible necessarily. It's because most banks are less likely to approve small loans for poor people who are needing to make ends meet, looking to buy a house, or starting a small business. Now, in one of the poorest parts of the country, the Mississippi Delta, a model of community banking by traditional banks, credit unions, and nonprofit organizations has helped a growing number of poor Mississippians break out of that vicious cycle. The institutions receive incentives and funds from a government program called the Community Development Financial Institutions Fund. The stories of how these CDFI banks have worked with community members to significantly help improve lives is the subject of a heartening new special report in the latest issue of Yes Magazine. It's called Banking on Justice, and its author, James Trimarco, who is the senior editor at Yes Magazine, now joins me. Welcome to the program, James.
Thanks so much for your interest in this story, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the actual conditions within the Mississippi Delta area. I think those people who've never traveled there or maybe, you know, have any roots there don't really realize when we talk about being poverty-stricken, this is a part of the United States that really might resemble, you know, walking into a third world nation. Just paint a picture for us for how severe poverty is in this part of the country.
Yeah. The Delta has very concentrated land ownership. A bunch of small landowners own vast farms, while the majority of people tend to own nothing. You'll often be surprised walking around the Delta. You know, you'll talk to someone who has what seems like a middle-class job. For example, they'll work for the city or be a nurse, and their salary will be less than $20,000. It's majority African American, one of the most African American areas of the United States, and the poverty has a very long history. You know, it goes back to the freeing of the slaves.
And so you found, of course, that a lot of the folks who you profile in your article who have managed to lift themselves a little bit out of that poverty trap before were relying on payday lenders, which, of course, most people in the United States are familiar with. They're very prevalent in poor urban areas and big cities, but they're also prevalent in rural, poor parts of the country. How reliant are poor Mississippi on payday lenders, and how, you know, I mean, as you said, somebody who has a middle-class job might still be earning $20,000 a year and just no way to make ends meet.
So Mississippians in the Delta rely on payday lenders to an incredible degree. Some data from the Center for Responsible Lending suggests that the average Mississippi resident spends about $420 a year on payday loans, which is much more than the second highest state. And that's not even just looking at the Delta, that's the whole state. In a lot of towns, you see payday lending stores will be, you know, one after another on the main strip. And the background to this is that for-profit banks don't really make any money on, for example, a loan of $1,000 to somebody who has like a dental, needs to pay their dentist or needs to pay for a flat tire or something like that. The banks, for-profit banking just isn't set up to provide that essential service.
Right, and that's a really important point. You point out in your piece that it costs the bank about the same amount to process a small loan versus a very large loan. So naturally, they're going to want to process or be more likely to process the larger loans because overall, the money they would make in interest would be much bigger, and it would cost them the same amount to process a big loan.
Exactly, yeah. You know,
So then the payday lenders were filling that vacuum, basically.
They do. There's nationally about 27% of Americans either have no bank account or they have a bank account but still rely on payday loans. In the Delta, that number is about 50% of people who either have no bank account or they do but still rely on payday loans.
Wow.
So it's kind of the ground zero for financial exclusion and exploitation.
Right, and then you end up paying exorbitant interest fees based on that. And sometimes people aren't even realizing that they're paying these exorbitant amounts till they sit down and do the math, because of course, having immediate access to a small loan to just get by from one day to the next provides enough relief that you're not stopping to look at the big picture. Tell us about the financial literacy classes that a lot of folks who ended up taking advantage of these CDFI banks that I mentioned started them on their journey to first understand the big picture and we should all, of course, be taking financial literacy classes, but those often seem to be the missing first step to breaking out of a cycle of poverty, right?
I think so. And it's funny because I changed my own financial habits after I reported this
Huh.
story. I had never taken a financial literacy class and didn't really save or even think about this topic that much. And after these people living below the poverty line in the Mississippi Delta told me what they had learned in financial literacy class, I just used what they told me. It's interesting how this story starts. A for-profit community bank in the Delta realized that most of the people who lived around there didn't have the kind of credit or the financial literacy they would need to really be good customers. And so they, I'm talking about Guaranty Bank and Trust, which is headquartered in Belzona. They hired a local person to be a community liaison, and then he started this financial literacy course,
And so
which
this is
just goes
also,
through the
go
basics.
ahead.
It goes through the basics of what a credit score is, the importance of actually banking your income, like putting your income in the bank. A lot of people in this area have very bad memories of interacting with bankers who may have discriminated against them racially, or who may have just taken advantage of them or their family members in the past. So there's like a broken trust there, and then that broken trust further isolates people and keeps them out of, and makes their credit terrible,
Right, we have a terrible legacy of racial discrimination for housing loans and all sorts of things like that. So let's talk about how this program is administered, where it comes from. The CDFI institutions, this is basically a government program, as I understand it, as you explain it in your article, that gives incentives because there are not many incentives to give small loans to poor folks. There is a government program that gives incentives for banks to do this, the CDFI program. How did this start? How big is this program? And how useful has it been in the Mississippi Delta to infusing cash into poor communities?
Yeah, so it really begins with redlining. For about 60 years, the United States government actively encouraged banks to discriminate racially, which has helped to damage those relationships I was talking about even further and contributed to the incredible difference in wealth that you see between, for example, white families and black families all across the United States. That goes way beyond the difference in income. We're talking about white families with college educations being worth, on average, about $300,000, and African American families with a college degree being worth $26,000.
Wow.
So that's an incredible difference. In order to try to heal the relationship between the financial sector and, in particular, African American families, the US government passed a number of laws, beginning with the Fair Housing Act, which banned racial discrimination in housing loans. Then later, the Community Reinvestment Act, which required banks to demonstrate that they somehow make loans in their community. It's been widely criticized for not being fully enforced, And, you know, these banks all get a grade, but almost all of them get an A grade. So, you know, bankers still see that as a regulatory burden, but, you know, many community activists don't feel like the Community Reinvestment Act does enough. On the heels of that legislation, in 1994, we get the bill that creates the Community Development Financial Institutions Fund. And this one goes a little bit further. It asks banks and credit unions and nonprofit loan funds to prove to the government that they are mission-driven, that they're motivated by a mission to help low-income communities, and that more than 50% of their assets are actually invested in those communities. And once they're certified, they can apply for monetary awards. You know, some of the community banks in the story have received, you know, a few million dollars, maybe like $4.5 million, which in banking terms isn't really huge money. But if we're talking about loans that aren't necessarily profitable, that can make the difference between whether this happens or whether it doesn't.
And it's not just banks, right? You point out it's nonprofit organizations can get the status, credit unions, traditional versus slightly non-traditional banks, et cetera.
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. So if you look at, for example, California's CDFI sector, it's mostly nonprofit loan funds. So these are very powerful and flexible organizations that can get money, they can take investment, for example, from another bank or maybe from a foundation, and then they'll make a series of loans. And this can be very powerful, for example, in the world of cooperatively owned businesses, worker-owned cooperatives. There are like very important financing that patterns that come from loan funds. The interesting thing is that in while California, you see the CDFIs are mostly loan funds, in Mississippi, it's mostly banks. So this is a unique thing about Mississippi, that here we see the like world of community banking actually go and become community development financial institutions. That hasn't really happened in any other state. Hmm.
So let's get to the good news part of your story. The stories of primarily Africa, I think you most profile almost all African American residents of Mississippi in the Mississippi Delta area, starting with Katie Alexander. Tell us the story of Katie Alexander, how she started out and where she ended up after being able to get some assistance as this community development model is working.
Yeah, as she told me her story, it really caught my attention. This is a person whose parents were both civil rights organizers. You know, Mississippi has this incredibly vibrant history of radical organizing for the especially for voting rights for African Americans. Her parents were deeply involved in that, and her father was murdered for that involvement, probably for that involvement. And we don't know exactly what the motivation of the shooter was, but he was murdered after conducting a voting rights campaign. She stayed in that neighborhood despite that violent history and works for the city of Rolling Fork. The block where she lives was named after her father. The name was changed, but she couldn't get a loan to purchase a house, you know, as a low-income person until she took a financial education program, you know, worked on her credit score a bit. And then it's really that the bank got to know her through the education program and then made the decision based more on her character than on her credit score.
And so what's also really interesting about this model of community banking is that the banks that are giving the loans are in, you know, are part of the community. And so that trust, person-to-person trust, is what often forms the basis of being able to make loans and have higher or lower default rates on loans. It reminds me of the kind of banking, development banking that we've seen in poor third world countries where, you know, poor women, microloans, et cetera, you know, that are very much based on person-to-person trust and knowing one another in the community. How important is it that this is money from the federal government, but really being loaned to and paid back between community members, people who literally live in the same areas and know one another personally?
It's incredibly important. I crunched some numbers showing how effective these loans are and how many applications for home loans that come from really low-income folks get approved by CDFIs despite the low default rates. And I went back to the bankers and said, you know, how is it that you're able to loan to really poor people and get the loans paid back? And they said, it's about the relationships. You know, we sit down with them, we talk to them about their income, and we design a loan system that works for them. That's not something that a bank with only profit on its mind is going to do, because the time costs money.
So basically, you have these success stories of people like Katie Alexander. You also profile farmers. Mississippi Delta is a very rural area. Give us an example of one of the farmers who you profiled, who basically was able to, through getting a loan from a bank, a CDFI bank, was actually able to start his own farm. And, you know, something that we talk so much these days in states like California about farmers and farm-to-table and local food production. How did this one Mississippi man who you profile in your piece actually make that dream come true for himself?
The really big thing that happened for these farmers through CDFIs was the creation of a worker-owned cooperative. So the Mississippi Delta has this incredible history. There was a time about the year 1900 when the Delta had the highest rate of Black farm ownership in the whole United States, because the land was cheap and freed slaves were able to clear the swamp and buy their own farms. Those people, their descendants now, a lot of them lost their farms. The ones that remain are mostly doing like rather small farms, and it's hard for them to make a profit selling, peas and vegetables out of the back of a truck. And so CDFI collaborated with these farmers, gathered about 100 of them into a worker-owned cooperative, helped to finance all the training that went into that. And now those people have significantly higher incomes because they all sell together at a market. Some of them told me their revenue had gone up like 20%, that they were able to buy new equipment and employ new farm workers. That to me was a really startling story, because financing worker-owned cooperatives is hard anywhere. Financing it among, you know, low-income African-American farmers in Mississippi is almost unheard of.
So this model that you profile in your article in Yes Magazine, Banking on Justice, how could it apply to other parts of the country? And does the CDFI fund, federal fund, need more infusions? Does Congress need to approve a bigger pot from which to fund this type of banking, so that people who are forgotten by big banks actually, you know, have some way to get out of these cycles of poverty?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, Sonali. So I think a data point that really helps here is to know that when you look at all the banking assets in the United States, it's about 0.04% that's controlled by CDFIs. So those credit unions and banks and loan funds that are in the system that are doing anti-poverty mission-driven lending are, you know, a tenth of 1%, you know, they operate a tiny portion of all of the banking funds. And with that little tiny slice of money, especially on the Indian reservations of North and South Dakota, Appalachia, the Mississippi Delta, the hardest hit parts of the U.S., these organizations are the sort of bedrock groups that move capital into those places that almost nobody ever moves capital into. I do think that this reporting begs the question, what, you know, what if we invested more deeply and got more than 0.04%? What if we got close to 1%? You know, what would be possible then?
And of course, really, the return on investment for taxpayers is huge, and our own tax dollars going into these funds to help other Americans, the poorest Americans, is just such a remarkable thing. But of course, sadly, our government is stuck in a gridlock, and both major parties seem to be intent on helping Wall Street more than Main Street. James, your article is really eye-opening. Where can people get a hold of it? Is it available online?
It sure is. www.yesmagazine.org is the place to go, and the article's front and center over there.
We'll post a link to yesmagazine.org from our website later today. Thanks so much, James.
Thank you, Sonali.
James Trimarco is the senior editor at Yes Magazine. We've been talking about his report, Banking on Justice. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.